Hello again. This is the last in our series of oral history podcasts for this year, and it's a special story we have to share with you. In honor of Oregon's sesquicentennial, the Cedar Mill Community Library has been recording the stories of immigrants or descendants of recent immigrants to Oregon. In this audio, you will hear Alice Kearns, a Romanian Jew who survived the Holocaust and the concentration camps at Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen to eventually settle in the Portland area. Hers is a special story of hope and perseverance, and I hope you enjoy it and the rest of our series. It has been an honor to record all of these amazing stories.
Hi, my name is Mark Richardson. I'm a librarian at the Cedar Mill Community Library, and today I am here with Alice, and she's going to tell us a little bit about herself. So, Alice, why don't you tell us your name?
My name is Alice Kern, K-E-R-N.
Okay. And where did you come from, and what year did you come to Oregon?
I came from Romania. Actually, I was first deported to two concentration camps, and then I came to Portland.
What year did you come to Portland?
What year? 1948.
So originally you were from Romania?
Yes, border Romania and Hungary.
Okay. So was it the Hungarian portion of Romania?
It used to be
part of Hungary.
Until First World War. And then the Romanians took over again, and it became Romania.
So tell us a little about why you ended up in Oregon, and what were the circumstances? You mentioned the concentration camps.
Well, I had a very fortunate, beautiful upbringing. And my mother was very interested for my brother, who was about less than 2 years older. She just exposed us to all the amenities of life. Theaters, movies, vacations. Not my father so much, because he was very religious Jew. His belief was restriction. My mother made it sure that he will take me for walks every Sunday morning. And I was so proud of him. Nice, tall man, blue eyes, blonde hair, and tipping his hat to all my teachers if he met them. So it was a beautiful era for me between. I was born in 1923 and stayed home till 1944. I had no idea there was a war. Actually, I just went to school. My life was dancing and music. And we never had a car. We never had water in the house. We had to go to the bathroom to the third yard someplace. Mm-hmm. But we were happy. We were very content. And my father was a very curious young man, so he traveled the region before he settled down and found my mother across the river, which divided us from Czechoslovakia. And he brought her over. She was a young girl. And he opened the first cheese shop in Sziget. And so he knew the peasants all around, because he used to travel just to see in case for a business later on. They came to town, the peasants, and sat down on the street once a week selling their cheeses. And my father said, listen, this is not hygienic. You better let me have it in my store. I have some shelves with screens, and I'll buy it from you. And so they did. They sold the cheeses. He made good on that, the first business. And then the sky fell
right.
In 1944. Hitler called up the king. He would like to deport all the Jewish people. and the big dirty lies, and without the king answering, he went into hiding. He didn't want to collaborate. But he had a young son, and by then the Iron Guard in Romania started to be very strong, and they were persecuted already, the Jewish people, and we had to wear the yellow star to everybody to see we were Jewish. I didn't care, I was proud to wear it, but it was depressing time for such a happy upbringing now to be afraid. I didn't know why I should be afraid, because they never told us about the war coming or started in Germany.
Right.
There was no war. Hitler just entered all the countries in Europe by saying, I have to deport you Jewish people. And everybody let him do it.
Yeah.
In 1939, I think, the Italians came through my hometown. They were shipped to the Russian front through this north. Siget was on the north, and then came Poland and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came through Siget,
okay,
my hometown. And they saw the Jewish people humiliated, kicked off of the sidewalks, and many other things, standing in line. They gave the Hungarians authority, the Germans. The Romanians disappeared. And so the Hungarians took the liberty to fight for their rights, because Hitler promised to annex back Transylvania for them. And they took liberties. So it was very, very hard to take. But as young girls, you know, 19, 20 years old, we didn't care. My parents had a hard time to cope with all this humiliation against the Jews. And my father got a heart attack. He was 52 years old and passed away. And I thought at that point, I died too, because I loved him, you know. So, no father. My mother was not very good in the business, but she was there, standing from morning till evening, and it got worse and worse. 1944, orders came all over town. They opened ghettos. Luckily, my house fell into the ghetto area. And my friends all came over. They each were set in different homes. My mother opened our duplex, and in every room a family moved in.
Mm.
They had to throw the furniture out to sleep on the floor, accommodating them. And I'm still sleeping in a feather bed. We had one nice warm room, and the kitchen was ours. And then they started to humiliate us by taking us one by one next door to search. And girls came back crying. We didn't know what's going on. When it was my turn, I had a little silver necklace with a Jewish star. And this Hungarian soldier with the turkey feather, you take that off and give it to me. So I took it off and gave it to him. I mean, it has no value. I still have my life. But I was allowed to go back. And my mother was there, and I always just felt sorry for her because she was so good to everybody and helping and social and family ways. And now she was sitting there like in a coma. One early morning, 1944, I think it was still very, very early. They knocked on our gate. Get dressed and go outside. What shall I take along? My favorite grand piano. I just grabbed a very nice cover from the couch. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
But they let us bake a bread first. The bakery was next door. When this was done, we went outside. But we had two little children with us. So my mother, she was on one end, the children in the middle, and I was on the other side. And we just cling to each other. I had my mother, actually, that's how I felt secure. So I started writing my book down the street, and I just look at the homes. I knew everybody where they lived, and every little pebble on the street I used to know. And they deposited us in a synagogue only for men overnight. And a storm broke out. Next morning, no washing, no combing hairs, no nothing, no food. Marching through this town, my favorite little town where I grew up. And I keep on looking to the left and to the right and like etching it in my memory. I wasn't aware of it. But until the railroad station. And there was a long line with cattle cars, box cars without windows. They just delivered animals in it. They started to separate us in groups and forced us to get into those cars. And I think my mother and the two kids, we were the last one in that group, so as we came, we had to really climb high. So we just dug down right by the entrance. That was it. Where we go, what's going to happen? And that was going on for 3 days and two nights, no food, no water. The other half of the wagon, somebody passed away. And we heard some screaming or crying, but you don't have time to listen.
Right.
That was too scary.
Yeah.
So you just sit. You sit. And then on the third day, the cattle cars opened. It was still dark outside. And we were told, jump down. And my first instinct was, but my mother, how can she jump? It was high. And I pulled my hair down. I should look old. And, you know, I didn't want to look pretty anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I jumped down. We get an order, start walking. Somebody called out my little nephew, the Silvio was his name. He was wearing, my mother gave him to wear my brother's coat. It was way down to the ground. Somebody thought maybe he looked old enough, so they sent him to the men's selection group. right the way men's were going that way, we girls and women and children in one long line. So we walk ahead in the dark, and this lady who shared with us the house, she broke out crying. She knows we are going to be killed, and boy, was she screaming. So a German soldier walks by and said, "Well, madam, we are not murderers." Then no time, I'm facing an officer. The officer never talks. Motions right, left, and the people gets the message. I looked at him, and like I say, I always used to philosophize about faces, and he had a good, nice face. I thought, gee, in the uniform, he was handsome. I wasn't afraid. But he motioned for me to go to my right, and my mother with the two little kids to the left. Not thinking, when they started to go to left, I just put my foot out and started to follow. And no sooner a soldier came, he almost stabbed me because I disobeyed this officer. That was the first time I faced the infamous Dr. Mengele. And of course, he sent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to the gas chambers right away. Women, children, pregnant women. He had an eye who to send to the right and left. See? So I went to my right, and here I discovered my best girlfriend from home with her mother and with her sister. And, oh, come on, let's walk together. And they took me. From there on, we were always together. And that was Auschwitz, the death camp, with the gas chambers and the crematoriums. But I never heard about it. Even later, if they talked about crematorium, what did I know? I didn't understand what they were talking. But they were there. So I had to face it three times during the summertime because I lost lots of weight. But in 1944, the camp was all built up. There were previous German girls already there, Jewish and non-Jewish. And they had to build the roads and the barracks. So when we came, everything was clay and not a blade of grass or a tree or a bush. And they placed us in a barrack with cubby holes. But before that, we had to go into a hall and of course completely undressed and shaved our beautiful curls. And then they threw at us a gray sack dress and some worn out shoes. And as we were standing still there, a girl came by and threw my own shoes to my feet. She said, "They are too small, nobody can wear it." So I had to wear my own favorite shoes for a long time until the weather turned awful. The rain and mud and it started to disintegrate. We didn't have much to do in the beginning in Auschwitz. But they knew the supervisors, the German soldiers and the women, they knew 1944, they knew they lost the war. But we had no idea, and we never talked, of course, politics or anything. So they never came out. Only the women came to count us every dawn. The stars were still out. We had to stand outside, 5 abreast, be counted. And at lunch again, at noon again, and before we went home, we always had to be counted. They wanted to see. Nobody should run away or... No work. I thought it was even worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we were just sitting around, you know. And then my girlfriend's mother decided, she looked at poor us with the bald heads. She said, oh, you know what, I better start teaching you cooking. So when we survive, we go home and you will know how to cook. So she kept us busy. But can you imagine for 2,500 people we were deported that day, 250 were selected to live, and 2 mothers, and one of my girlfriend's mother. So I was fortunate. And we stayed in this cubbyhole, feet to feet, and hungry and thirsty. And of course, the Polish people had the upper hand. And they had a little room for themselves, nicely decorated. And they came by, this one, she was the supervisor, and walked up and down and cursed us. You are so lucky to be here. And while you were sleeping in your warm beds, we had to build all these barracks and the roads. But later on I found out they had food in those days. When we came, there was no more food. So what we got is early at dawn, a drink of hot something, they called it coffee. It was very, very sweet. And a slice of bread, and off we had to go to work then later on.
So were these Polish people also prisoners in the camp, or were they the ones administrating the camp?
No, they were the supervisors.
Supervisors,
for barracks after barracks after barracks,
okay.
See? Because the Germans never showed up anymore.
Okay.
And in fact, when there were orders to select, let's say, a barrack to be annihilated, then they sent our own people, the Jewish men, to take us into the gas chambers. Those soldiers, they had parties with their women. They never wanted to come out again. But that was the end, almost the end of the war.
Right.
And they knew that the Russians are approaching. So they were afraid and disgusted and didn't want to come out. Okay, we had no idea. In the meantime, we go to work night shift. And when we came back once, they tattooed our arm. They said, girls were in that hall, we are going to just give you a number. She said, give me your arm. So I stretched out my arm, and she poked in those numbers, and I thought, gee, she was an artist, because some other girls, they got huge letters and huge numbers, crooked. Some got it up on their arms.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, that's okay with me. It didn't hurt. But it turned out that we lost our name. After that, the C-lapel, the roll call, was never by name, just numbers.
Maybe you can tell us about getting out after you were in the concentration camps.
Okay. In 1945, January, and we are ordered to get out and start walking, snow-covered road, everything frozen. Girls had no more shoes, no food, no water. And they chased us from Auschwitz into Germany. So the Russians, we left the camp, the Russians invaded it. That we heard. And we felt so bad that we couldn't be liberated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we walked through Germany and on, and it was depressing to see a large group of women, you know, and the people were on the streets, they saw us, and only two soldiers, one in the back, and one in the front. But they had the guns.
Right.
So we couldn't fight them. In Germany, someplace, I lost all my friends. I don't know where they are. So I could never double check where we were in Germany. But they put us in open cattle cars.
Uh-huh.
See? And there where a mass hysteria broke out because people were thirsty. And they had to drink their own urine. Mm-hmm. Until a woman in a corner started to pray and she said, "Let everybody pray." And then they quieted down. We all fell asleep. Next morning I wake up and snow is falling off of my head. I had a small spoon, I took it out, and I ate all the snow from all over I could, and so did the others. That was a lifesaver. Then we found ourselves in Bergen-Belsen in Germany. We heard that my best girlfriend was the supervisor of one of the cabins. She was the supervisor. And when she heard that this transport is coming from that certain place where she used to be, she came running and she said, "Don't worry, I'll come and pick you up and take you to my own cabin." I was always saved somehow. But at this point, I was already with my aunt. She saved my life. And she knew, she told me why my mother was sent to the left. If the children wouldn't have been there, she would have come with me to the right. But because Mengele didn't want to cause commotion, she sent her away with the children. So Bergen-Belsen had no more crematoriums, at least no more gas chambers. We didn't have to be scared every moment that they are going to cremate us or gas us. Nothing to do. Nothing to do. 45. January, February, March. The sun is shining and I stumble outside. I always used to love the sun. But now they got an order in that camp. The Allies are coming, the British, the Americans. You have to kill them all. So how do you do that? They figured out there was a camp not too far away from ours, all infested with tuberculosis. They brought them over. And suddenly the girls are dying like flies. Temperature, roaming around and dying. Of course there is no doctor, no nothing. By then, we had no more food, the last week of the war, and no bread, so water, no water. And everybody is hysteric. They were thirsty.
Yeah.
So that was already 1945, and I fell in a coma. And I was very content. I was philosophizing, maybe this is how people die, because I couldn't hear, I couldn't see, nothing was hurting. But I was thirsty. And my aunt really crawled out from this barrack and brought me a container with water. Everybody else was just crying for water, but she couldn't walk anymore. And then the Nazis turned off the water supply, and the food supply was poisoned in the kitchen, because I was told by the liberators, by the Americans and the British, they could not understand why everything, no water, they turned off everything. I got a touch of TB. I fainted outside, and just once. Then my girlfriend, who was the barrack supervisor, didn't let me go out anymore. And that was good. And then when I fell in coma, I wake up shooting outside and screaming and running. And I opened my eyes and I felt so disturbed, you know. I had such a peaceful sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And the door opened and a very handsome green beret hat picks in. And he shuts the door, but they come back and they speak English. So I took some English back home, conversation English. And they said, don't worry, you are liberated, we'll take care of you. And later on I found out that this handsome young boys, they were the American field servicemen. They were always on the head of the marching groups of the soldiers. They built a Red Cross ambulance, and as they kept on penetrating Germany, all the little places, they discovered many, many other camps. Nobody knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they discovered ours, which was tucked in deep in the woods.
Mm.
So they really saved my life too. We were liberated. Now, it was a chaos there, you know. So suddenly some Swedish nurses show up. There is a young man in Sweden, Bernadotte, a prince. He was sent to save the European Jews. And he went to Hungary and falsified papers. Jewish people were already on the wagons to be deported. And he came running, showing that they are not Jews and you cannot take them. Mm-hmm. And he saved many lives. Now, he sent the Red Cross nurses to Bergen-Belsen. And they told us that if we want to go to Sweden, they are going to take us. But they took only the incapacitated ones. I couldn't walk, I couldn't eat, you know. I was less than 50 pounds by then, covered with lice. It looked horrible, walking skeletons. But They came, those young men, with their stretchers and put us on it and on trains and on boats, and we wound up in Sweden. Of course, they cleaned us and gave us clean clothes and food. And eventually, it was allowed for a photographer to come in. It was a convalescent place. And he asked me to marry him. But he spoke German and I spoke Hungarian. But I had a girlfriend and she was always in the middle. We used to take walks. That's about it. And he said something in German to her. She translated to me. That was our conversation and our courtship. But it happened that I got better. And they sent me to an army camp next to Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. That was horrible, horrible, just like a shed, you know. It was very bad. But somehow or another, I found my older brother in Paris.
Wow.
Who ran away, who escaped from the Nazis in 1938 on a bike over the mountains to Spain.
Wow.
And when I was in bed, I remembered my mother showed me a letter from him, and I remembered the address. Dr. Coppel, Madrid. And I called the nurse, please send that to Madrid, and I'm looking for my brother. And they found him.
Wow, that's great.
So he kept on encouraging me, don't worry, I'll come and get you and you will live with me and so forth. But I didn't want to live with him because he was 14 years older and was very strict with us.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, no way, I want to be on my own. And so this nice German guy, he was born in Austria. He was taken 8 weeks in Dachau, broke for life. And never wanted to talk about it. They were brainwashed. Never ever should they say what happened there. And he lost his father in the First World War. He could never, never talk about that. He was so hurt. He was 5 years old. But I hear him talking about the opera house in Vienna and concerts, and he could recite half an hour poems, what he used to recite when he was in the grade school. Very intelligent man. And I always said, if I will ever get married, I don't want a rich man. I want an intelligent man. Mm-hmm. And I found him. And whatever he saw in me, he found it. And we got married. He found out his brother lived in Portland.
What was his name?
Leo Kohn, K-O-H-N.
Okay.
And they had a small grocery store on Hasselow Street someplace. And when they found out that his brother is alive, they were very close back home. You have to come. And we had to sell. What did we sell? A few clothes. I gave away all my warm clothes for the Swedish because my sister-in-law kept on saying, you don't need to bring anything warm. Portland is always summer. That was in 1948. Mm-hmm. So I came without a coat, without a sweater. I left everything there.
And what was your husband's name?
Hugo. He invented toys for the children, and he was a good mathematician for the kids to help, and physics. He knew everything, and yet he could not advance. Wound up in a furniture factory here in Portland. For 16 years he was working spraying furniture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then one day he decided he knows enough, and he went on his own without advertising. People came to him and loved him, and he opened a little shop on Southeast 39th and Gladstone, and his name is still there. Somebody bought his name. Hugo Kern Furniture Refinishing.
Mm, great.
And they even called today, Hugo, come on, I have something to be refinished. And those guys said, sorry, he passed away.
Yeah.
See? Very intelligent, very, very special guy anyway. But he also passed away about 3 or 4 years ago.
So about what year did you come to Portland?
1948. We settled first on the coast, and then the children said, no, that's for us too far, so you better come to town. And they put us in Rose Schnitzer Manor.
Oh.
The old age retirement place. It was very beautiful. We were only 21 people, one small building in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And then the population found out what a nice life we have and everything. Then they started to build additions. And that I didn't like.
Yeah.
And some just died overnight, our best, you know, acquaintances, told my husband, no, I cannot take that. And we couldn't eat all the food anyway, and we spent our whole Social Security just to live there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we moved out to Bethany Boulevard, a beautiful apartment. He was 96.
Wow.
And we went shopping one day and he collapsed. He just was living another month, force feeding and everything. But he passed away.
When you got to Oregon in 1948, what were the biggest challenges that you faced while you were here?
I had 21 beautiful upbringing years. The Nazis could not destroy them. They just could not. And in 1948, I see people having homes and driving cars and have children. I could not have children yet for 5 more years because of this TB attack. Mm-hmm. And I advanced. My husband, low-key, he goes to the factory and works hard, barely made minimum income. We never traveled, we never had monies, we never had savings account. Just going to parks with the kids, we raised 4 little girls anyway, later on. And I just wanted to be like everybody else. That's how I was brought up.
Yeah.
You know, other survivors who were very young, they forgot what it meant to have a nice life.
Yeah.
They hated, they were angry. I was always happy, and I told even my children, I don't know why. I don't have any reason to be happy every day, but I feel happy. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I never grew up, but somehow I had my eyes and ears open, and I heard once they are building 3 little small homes in North Portland. And I told my husband, well, before that, we kept on sharing homes with American people. We were told it will be a good influence on us to learn the way here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't like it. So I called up, and eventually we bought a small home in North Portland on Meir Street. We were very happy here, but very low-key life.
Yeah.
See, we never could. If I said to my husband, I need a pair of shoes or a dress, oh no, not now, I can't afford it. That was his motto, we can't afford it. I grew up with everything in my life, even more than everything. So if he said we can't afford it, okay, he was older, he knew what he was saying.
Yeah.
I just accept.
Was there a big Jewish community here, a lot of other survivors?
Yes, the community was here, but they were shocked when they heard about survivors. They did not know where to place us. And of course, the survivors, some are mad, some are angry, some are hateful, you know. And before I came to Portland, we settled down also in California, in Palm Springs.
Okay.
And I went to the synagogue to enroll my youngest daughter. She was with us. And they asked me there if I could help. And I said, I don't know what to do, but I raised already four little girls. But I like music. So four organizations gave me a job to have musical affairs with them. Four. And I said, okay, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew I can do it.
Yeah.
And eventually I met in Palm Springs many survivors, which were just mingling there. They didn't want to be known.
Okay.
No. And I brought them together for many years. I was survivor's president there. And then we came to Portland. Nobody had organization about survivors. But I had four girls of mine, which they never knew what happened to me because I never was able to talk to them. And in Palm Springs, it happened that a clergyman sat next to me once and he wanted some information about daily routines in a camp. By then, I had a stack of papers because my memory came back.
Mm-hmm.
And what do I write in Hungarian? So I gave him the papers, but a girlfriend of mine, she went to college, she started to translate it a little bit. And he called back that, Alice, I found what I was looking. And he published the book, and his wife edited.
That's great. What was the name of the book?
Tapestry of Hope. My son-in-law called me up one day because they kept on telling me, you have to call it Out of the Ashes. And I thought, well, that isn't me.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if I was there.
Once you came to the United States, did you have to deal with any sort of prejudice when you were here?
We heard about the Ku Klux Klan, yes, but I never had any problems with them.
Yeah.
Because when my book was published, schools kept on inviting me and churches and groups. And I'm not angry and I don't hate. Sorry.
Yeah.
I wasn't brought up like that. And so they never hurt me, but some were clobbered because they talked. They looked for trouble.
Yeah, okay.
So they got it.
Yeah.
But I heard about them. I was in Tillamook, I think, yeah. And speaking in a school, and the leader there, they are very strong.
Huh.
Yeah. They said, why do you call her to speak? Why don't you call us to talk to you? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I heard the conversation.
Yeah.
It was scary. I knew they were there, and then a woman told me that she sent her sons to day camp, and they came home crying because they were indoctrinated to be Nazis, and they got boots and guns, and called their mother, come and take us home. But I always said, look, I know people who committed crimes. I heard enough. But I cannot live to worry about it because there are organizations and they will take care of them.
Right.
I cannot.
And did you or your family ever consider moving to Israel? Or?
No, I never thought about it. I even forgot for many years to go home. Only when I started to write, the reason was that I was debating with myself, did I ever say thank you to my mother for all the good things she did for us?
Mm-hmm.
That was my first reason to start to pour out thank you. But no, Israel, in Romania, you know, the people could not buy land. They could live there, but no land. So the Jewish people couldn't be farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So they settled in smaller towns and opened businesses like my father, and they were very good furniture builders and
right.
home builders. So, and they made a good life. My girlfriend's parents, they were quite rich. They bought land, so after the war, the children went to Israel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but no. Not
you. Did you go back to Romania?
I was in Romania then in 1995
okay.
with my four daughters and a videographer. And we went to my hometown. I found the house. Somebody lives there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't suppose to talk because so many people were killed.
Yeah.
But I never recovered anything. And I went again to my hometown because a church, a singing group needed a translator, languages, German, Hungarian, Romanian.
Yeah.
And they paid my trip. And I went again and I found my father's grave. And I still would like to go again, you
yeah.
know. It's a very hard trip.
Yeah, I imagine.
Very hard to. But there is, in my hometown, a young Romanian man. And he decided to write a book about the whole region who was deported.
Uh-huh, okay.
And he wrote me in email. He sent lots of information, like my older brother's friends. I remember all those names. They were all for Israel.
Hmm.
See, because they couldn't buy land, so they thought, well, they will go to Israel and build there.
Right.
course, I don't think they are there. Uh-huh. But it was a dream of those Jewish guys. And so this nice Romanian man got hold of my book on the internet. We sent him my copy of the book. And he was so taken. He said, I'm going to translate it in Romanian so people should know what happened.
That's right. Maybe you can tell a little bit about the education system that you went through in Romania versus what your daughters went through here.
Yeah. Well, we went 4 years elementary, and then 8 years I went lyceum. That's probably like high school, but we learned languages and history and geography and just about everything. I think we covered more than they do here. I couldn't finish the last year because then the situation changed and the Jewish girls could not go to school anymore.
Okay. Well, that's all of our questions.
So I just want to conclude with my children going to school. Of course, my husband helped them a lot with math and everything for a couple of years, and then everything changed in the school. He couldn't keep up with them.
Yeah.
But they were always good students, good, very good, just like my husband, good brains. And they each went through college, got nice awards, and all I wanted them to have a profession, because I never had a profession.
Yeah.
And they are each professionals.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate your positive outlook on life and your love of music. It's a great story.
I couldn't be anything else but what they made me. That's what they made me. To be content and happy and help others. Keep on going, step by step. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you.